On the record, we'll call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is now 1:06 p.m. Here with us developing a quorum are Representative Fields, Representative Hopkins, myself, Representative Puckett, Representative Rauscher, and Representative Hannon. I'm sure the others will be joining us momentarily. I'd like to say thank you to our recording secretary, Robin, on the airwaves, and our LIO moderator, Doug. Remind folks, please silence your cell phones as we convene this meeting. Today we have two items on the agenda, House Bill 349, Hearing Established Drilling Units and Spacing by Representative Rauscher, and also picking back up House Bill 171, PFAS Use and Remediation, Fire, Water, and Safety by Representative Hannon. First on the docket is House Bill 349. This is our first hearing of 349, and we have Representative Rauscher and his staff, Ryan McKee, here to provide us an introduction of the bill. If you folks can join the hot seat, I'd like to welcome Representative Shragi at 1:07 p.m. As a disclaimer, I sent a text to all the committee members that I was going to be late and then started it just about on time. So that's why folks are going to trickle in.
Thanks, Josiah.
Yeah, I was keeping y'all on your toes. Representative Rauscher, you can either sit at your seat or on the hot seat, whichever's fine.
You bet.
And on Teams, we've got a few folks joining us from the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Committee, Commission, and they'll provide a brief presentation, and then we'll have some discussion back and forth with committee member questions. So, Representative Rauscher, if you'd like to make an opening statement, and I know that we're probably going to go over to the folks online for the presentation, you're more than welcome to.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Chair Puckett. And for the record, my name is Representative George Rauscher, District 9. I'd like to thank co-chairs. I'd like to thank the chair, Chairman Puckett, and members of the committee for hearing this bill today. HB 349 was written because of the way we search for and produce oil in the 21st century. And it has changed since the 1950s and 60s. During that time, policymakers were worried that oil companies might drill too many vertical wells that were spaced too tightly together, resulting in oil left in the ground that could no longer be recovered. If you are to Google spindle top images, you'll see pictures of wells that are very close to each other, extremely close to each other. And as the practice over the years, things have changed. So today, no one is spending millions of dollars to drill unnecessary wells in Alaska. In a decade since the early days of the industry, advancements in drilling technology allows wells to be directionally drilled underground, sometimes with multiple lateral wells from a single mother bore or a parent well. Holes can be a few thousand feet deep, yet tens of thousands of feet long to recover greater amounts of oil and gas. Unfortunately, the outdated statutes that we have not kept up with in the advancements in the oil industry and gas industry over the years. The statutes being amended in this legislation were originally designed to provide oversight by involving another step. Provide assurance that perforations in the ground were not going to be too close, jeopardizing the structural integrity of the field or zone. This extra oversight is no longer necessary. It slows down development and costs the state time and money. HB 349 eliminates needless regulatory red tape as drilling and production processes have fundamentally changed since the statute was originally written. I hope the committee will understand and see the need for this timely legislation, and I'll now turn this over to my Chief of Staff, Ryan McKee, to provide a sectional analysis and introduce anyone who may or may not be online or in the room to testify. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Rauscher. Mr. McKee.
For the record, Ryan McKee, staff to Representative George Rauscher. Section 1, AS 31, 05.100A. This section amends Section 1, Part A, starting on page 1, lines 6 and 7. This would remove the hearing requirement before the Commission can establish the drilling units or units for each pool. Section 2, AS 31.05.100B. This section amends Section 2, Part B, starting with page 1, lines 14 and 15. This removes the notice and hearing requirement exceptions to the rules and spacing pattern, meaning that the need for proof of public notice of a hearing would no longer be needed. The remaining changes on page 2, lines 3, 4, 5, and 8 is legal language that was needed to update the bill to reflect the changes made above. And then online, we have from AOGCC, Jeremy Price and Jesse Chmielowski, who will be going over the presentation. And then if committee members also have questions for DNR, Graham Smith is also online to address any additional questions.
Thank you, Mr. McKee. Mr. Price and Jesse Chmielowski, please put your name on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Jeremy Price, the Public Commissioner of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. I appreciate the opportunity to address the committee this morning. The purpose of this legislation is to reduce administrative barriers. The AOGCC is tasked under Alaska Statute 31.05.100A and B with holding hearings for any changes to oil and gas coal unit designations, rules, or spacing patterns, even where all relevant properties within a given pool belong to a single owner. This requirement for hearings in every instance causes unnecessary delay to pool owners and generates unnecessary costs for the state, as the AOGCC must engage in the protracted process of issuing notice and holding hearings before taking action. HB 349 would update the process, reduce unnecessary delays to pool owners, and save the state time and money that would otherwise be spent on superfluous notice and hearing requirements. Section 1 of HB 3349 amends AS31.05.100A to remove the requirement the AOGCC must hold a hearing prior to establishing a drilling unit or units for each pool. To put it more plainly, under the existing statute, when an explorer discovers oil or gas, the statute requires the AOGCC to hold a hearing on the spacing of wells that will be drilled within the same pool, and establish a drilling unit or units for that pool. The default drilling unit size is a governmental section for gas and a governmental quarter section for oil. Section 1 of the bill removes the requirement to hold a hearing and the requirement to establish a drilling unit. Why is this necessary? The concept of establishing drilling units that are essentially boxes on a map where only one vertical well can be drilled within that box is completely outdated with horizontal drilling. Section 2 amends AS31.05.100B to make it discretionary rather than mandatory for the AOGCC to issue notice and hold a hearing in each instance when exception is granted to the rules or spacing patterns prescribed to a particular pool. With this change, AOGCC could allow the operator to drill additional wells within the same pool without having to go through 30 days of notice and comment followed by the issuance of a conservation order. From 2016 to 2020, prior to the pandemic, AOGCC publicly noticed 47 hearings on non-controversial well spacing exceptions that no member of the public requested nor submitted testimony. How this statutory change might impact AOGCC regulations can be seen in the materials that we've provided to the committee. And as you can see, the portion of the regulation that is deleted from the regulations if were to pass in 20 AAC 25.055A, the creation of drilling units would no longer be required. And in 20 AAC 25.055A3 and 4, the default drilling unit size of governmental section and quarter section would be repealed, and the spacing restriction between wells producing from the same pool would also be repealed. However, in terms of spacing restriction of wells drilled close to property lines, that regulation would remain to protect the correlative rights of owners of the resource. So at this point, I'm going to turn the time over to Commissioner Chmielowski to run through some examples of well space.
Thank you, Mr. Price. Ms. Chmielowski, if you can put your name on the record and continue the presentation.
Yes, thank you, Chair Putkatuk. May I just verify you can hear me?
We can hear you fine.
Great. Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Putkatuk and the committee. My name is Jesse Chmielowski. I'm the Engineering Commissioner at the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. Thank you for your consideration of this bill. It proposes to modify a statute that has not been changed since it was first adopted in 1955. I'd like to say at the beginning that, if approved, this bill would not impact the AOGCC's ability to fulfill its mission. It is an important update that would allow us to be more efficient. The title of the bill refers to drilling units, but the proposed language edits really have to do with inter-well spacing exceptions, or how far one well must be from another in the subsurface, and not just anywhere below the surface, but in the targeted productive reservoir. In the 1950s, when the statute was written, it was common for oil and gas fields to be developed with vertical wells. At times, operators would drill wells too close together, resulting in waste or reduction in the amount of hydrocarbons that can be recovered. Representative Rauscher referred to a photo of Spindletop that many of you have probably seen. That was a first-come, first-served approach. There were no controls on the developments then, and too many wells were drilled too close together. The reservoir pressure would drop rapidly, resulting in stranded reserves or waste. So, after the Conservation Act of the 1930s, agencies like the AOGCC were formed in states all over the country to prevent the waste of hydrocarbon resources. One way to prevent waste was to set default drilling units. In Alaska, the default drilling units are one governmental section for gas wells and one governmental quarter section for oil wells. I'll refer to some maps in my presentation that show you what a governmental section looks like. It's basically like a grid across a map. Only one well is allowed per default drilling unit unless the AOGCC grants a spacing exception, which requires a hearing. Again, the purpose of establishing default drilling units and requiring the AOGCC to hold hearings for spacing exceptions was to prevent waste of the resource, or alternatively, to encourage greater ultimate recovery of the resource. Now I'll talk about why allowing wells to be drilled closer than the default spacing encourages greater ultimate recovery. Today, with modern technology, wells are drilled based on geology and reservoir characteristics. Default drilling units based on governmental sections are out of date. It is common for wells to be planned and drilled closer than the default spacing. An interesting tidbit about Prudhoe Bay: when Prudhoe was first started up 44 years ago, the estimated recoverable reserves were 9 billion barrels of oil. Today, with advancements in drilling and reservoir management, the estimated recoverable reserves are about 14 billion barrels of oil. The point being that updating to current best practices is to the benefit of Alaska. I'll talk through a couple of recent examples that illustrate what I mean when I'm talking about inter-well spacing exceptions. And I believe you have some slides, or there's a slide up in front of your committee there. And I have two examples. One is for Blue Crest Energy in the Cook Inlet region, and one is for ConocoPhillips on the North Slope. And I would actually ask, Brian, if you could please switch to page two. I have two slides for my first example, but I like to start on the second page. So this, again, is for Blue Crest Energy. They operate the Cosmopolitan Unit on the Kenai Peninsula, and they have an onshore pad. So if you look at this map, you'll see that there's a bunch of green lines, and they all start sort of in the lower right-hand corner. That's the onshore drill pad location. And then below the surface, these wells extend out into the Cook Inlet area below the surface to the oil and gas reservoir. Now, hopefully you can see this. It's a little bit faint, but you'll see there's a bunch of small gray text written across the slide, section 27, section 26, section 34. That forms a grid pattern, and that's just to show you what the governmental sections are. It's basically a grid overlay onto the map. So each of these green lines is a well bore, and sort of off to the top left, you'll see that there's a series of dots and a bunch of sort of text that's hard to read, sort of right across the top of the well at the end of the well bore. Each of those is a lateral that comes off of the parent mother bore. They call them fishbone laterals. So if we could, Ryan, please go to slide one. This is a side view example of one of the fishbone wells that was drilled out in the Cosmopolitan Unit. So the well begins, and you don't see the total beginning of it, but it begins to the right. and it drills left across into the reservoir, and it TDs, or has the total depth end of well at the left. And then what the drilling rig did was it retracted, came back up hole, and drilled a bunch of laterals. So you can see how they all kind of go upward. They cross-section the entire reservoir from bottom to top. So the spacing between these individual fishbone laterals in a single well is about 800 feet, which resulted in the need for 7 or more spacing exceptions per well, because each of these fishbone laterals required an interwell spacing exception. But Bluecrest has tried several ways to develop this field and found this to be the best way to recover the most reserves. So modern well designs like this are used to optimize and improve the ultimate recovery. Any questions about my Bluecrest example?
I don't see any, Ms. Okay. Malowski.
Thank you. Well, I'll go to my second example, which is ConocoPhillips, and we'll start, should be slide 3, I guess, the main one. So this is for the Rendezvous Oil Pool, which is part of the Greater Moose's Tooth Unit in NPR Way. So you might have heard of it. This is a bird's eye view, you know, of the plan development, so you're looking kind of top down. Again, I just point out the grid pattern, which is the governmental sections that overlay the field. There's a curved sort of purple-reddish line that delineates the reservoir boundary of the Rendezvous Oil Pool. And then you see in the center there's a bunch of parallel lines that are sort of orange or brown looking. And those are the proposed well developments. And so you'll see a little spot in the middle. It's called MT7. That's the drill pad location. And then what they're planning to do is drill a bunch of wells from that location in this pattern that you see. And they're all sort of diagonal. Why are they a diagonal? It's because as they develop the field, they try to position the wells such that they get the best production. So they're accounting for the reservoir characteristics like permeability and porosity. So they're angling them in a certain way on purpose to get the best production out of the field. Rock, when it's laid down, can have different properties in different directions, depending on how it was deposited.
Ms. Chimel,
yes?
Sorry, wasn't sure if that was into the presentation.
No,
that slide,
not quite, but go ahead.
We've got Representative Fields with a question.
Thanks to the chair. What's the difference between permeability and porosity?
So porosity is how many like air gaps there are in the rock. But permeability is how easily can something flow through it. So you could imagine something that might have a lot of porosity in that it has a lot of air spaces, but the air spaces are not connected to each other, which would be permeability.
Thank you.
Thank you for the clarification. And then, just out of curiosity, the orange well plan lines, is that the extent of the reach of the lateral drilling from the well pad, or what, about how far is that reach?
Yeah, that's, several thousand feet is deceptive. I'll go to the next slide now. Actually, if we go to slide 4, it is, where they can reach reasonably well with the rig from that location. I was just going to say, if we can go to slide 4, it's a close-up of the wells design. So you can see how all the wells originate at that drill site. And they come out in different directions, but they're all sort of parallel. And what ConocoPhillips has found, and they have this in several of their fields, is they do this sort of parallel well design where they have alternating injectors and producers such that the injectors along the length of the lateral push the oil towards the producers, and they get, good sweep and recovery that way. So it's a zoomed-in view. I think, they have rigs that probably could drill farther if they really wanted to, but this was what they thought of as the optimal design. Of course, it's not developing the entire pool, as you can see from slide 3, but it is developing this section, which they consider, I think, the sweet spot of the reservoir oil pool. And so I just wanted to show you this as an example, as each of these wells, of course, cross multiple governmental sections, and there are multiple wells per governmental section, and so every well would require spacing exception, which is unnecessary to protect relative rights or prevent waste. This development will yield a greater recovery than the conventional vertical or slant well development with the default minimum spacing rules. So I'm almost done, but in summary, I wanted to say that the technical review of drilling permits by AOGCC engineers and geologists is robust and would not change. With the passage of this bill, the AOGCC will continue to fulfill its mission to prevent the waste of Alaska's valuable hydrocarbon resources. Thank you again for your consideration. And if you'll permit me, Chair Pukatuk, there's a couple of topics from the session at a previous House committee that I'd like to address.
Sure.
Okay. So I wanted to talk about a type of spacing exception that the AOGCC also oversees. That's different from what's addressed in the bill, but I wanted to talk about it because it may be something that you've heard of. So it's a spacing exception near a lease boundary where the ownership is not the same on both sides. The proposed bill that we're talking about today would only affect the requirement to notice hearings for interwell spacing exceptions. But I'd like to talk about this other type of spacing exception, which is deals with lease boundaries and how close a well can be drilled to a boundary where the ownership is not the same on both sides. So the AOGCC has strict rules on this and requires a minimum standoff from boundaries where the ownership is not the same. Specifically, AOGCC requires a minimum distance of 1,500 feet for an oil well and 3,000 feet for a gas well. The purpose of this is to protect correlative rights. Correlative rights are the rights of an owner of a resource to recover his or her share of that resource. The spacing exception requirement to protect correlative rights is not affected by the proposed bill and would be unchanged. The AOGCC would still be required to notice hearings for any spacing exception of this type. Chair, I had one more question that came up in a previous committee, and it sort of relates to a current event, so I'll just address it now. And the question was, would a spacing exception have prevented the gas leak on the Alpine CD1 drill site? And the answer is no, it would not have prevented the gas leak. As I mentioned earlier, interwell spacing exceptions, like the ones we are discussing in the proposed bill, address how far one well must be from another in the subsurface, and not just anywhere below the surface, but in the targeted productive reservoir. Talking specifically about the CD1 leak, the well was being drilled that targeted a deep reservoir zone. On its way, it drilled through a sand known as halo. Many wells have drilled through the halo sand with no issues, and it was not considered a productive hydrocarbon zone. And since it was not considered a productive hydrocarbon zone, cement was not placed across it during that stage of the well completion. In this case, the halo sand was unexpectedly productive and did start producing gas. The gas migrated up the well and into the thaw bulb. The thaw bulb is an area directly below the drill site where heat from production and injection wells has thawed out an area of the permafrost. Once the gas migrated into this thawed area, it came to surface at various locations via the path of least resistance. The source of the gas has been identified and is in the process of being cemented and isolated. Getting back to spacing exceptions, the CD1 well would not have required a spacing exception for the halo sand because it was not the targeted productive reservoir. And that concludes my remarks, Chair. Are there any questions?
Thank you, Ms. Chmielewski. I guess that's where the difference between porosity and permeability comes into play. Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All sorts of new words today. So on that note, learning the word correlative, put that into my brain. In the previous slide, Mr. McKee, if you could go back one slide to that one, the AOGCC well spacing exemption rule for ConocoPhillips example. If we're making sure that we keep the 1,500 feet away from the edge of where somebody else might be having a lease as well, would that 1,500 feet be the difference in the curvy solid purple line on this map? To the right-angled, slightly lighter color of the outer of that unshaded area, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it actually would be to the lease boundary, which is more of the squared-off boundary that you see. So you can see Conoco acquired leases to match the pool boundary, but the correlative rights issue would apply to the lease boundary, not necessarily the pool boundary. And you can see that all these wells, though, are offset from both the lease boundary and the pool boundary. Of course, they don't want to drill right up to the edge of the pool.
Follow up.
Did that answer your question?
Yes. So there would be an additional 1,500 feet between the right-angled lines and the start of somebody else's lease because ConocoPhillips is just looking at the pool boundary, which is the curvy purple line. So they're still staying away from the edge of the purple, and then they're still staying away from the edge of the pool boundary, and then there's an additional 1,500 feet difference between the squared off lines and where somebody else's lease would be starting.
Right. And AOGCC regulations or statutes relate to only the squared off lease boundary line. That's where we require the minimum standoff, and how close they decide to get to that is up to the operator. In this case, they're deciding to stay well within the pool boundary, which is an additional offset that we don't require. We require that offset from the lease boundary, which is the more squared off boundary.
Thank you. And then just one more follow-up for the map question. Looking at the squared off grid lines that we had talked about, the overlay of the grid lines, I see some bigger grid lines on this same map and some smaller ones. Can you tell me what the mileage dimension of those are so that I can put that into my brain and the other maps as well?
Yeah, and this map is, you know, quite larger scale. You know, you can see there's all these little numbers all across it. And I think, Jeremy, correct me if I'm wrong, I think a governmental section is, what, 640 acres?
Correct.
Okay, so a governmental section is 640 acres, and I think, you know, these governmental sections are going to be even smaller than maybe what you've been seeing as outlined here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from committee members? Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Price or Ms. Chmielewski, just because it hasn't come up here and I think it's always relevant to put on the record, could you describe the well spacing circumstances of Cook Inlet compared to the North Slope and when those requests or when the previous notifications for well spacing exemptions have come up with the So maybe talk about the frequency that you encounter them with North Slope leases versus the frequency in Cook Inlet leases.
Sure. Through the chair, this is, again, Jesse Chmielewski from the AOGCC. That's an excellent point. So between these two examples, Bluecrest Energy and ConocoPhillips, well, what I'll show you here is that we most often get these requests for interwell spacing exceptions in the Cook Inlet. And one of the main reasons is that, you know, in the North Slope, it's such a, you know, it's a remote location, it's a high-cost environment, so operators tend to fully plan their developments before they even really start drilling their wells. And so, for example, at this ConocoPhillips Rendezvous oil pool, they've pre-planned all the wells, and they come to the AOGCC with their plan really before they've even started drilling. So what we do is, what they'll do is they'll come to us for what we call pool rules, which is a set of guidelines for how best to manage the field. And the number one thing we always do in a pool rules application is we write a rule that these interwell spacing exception or interwell spacing requirement is no longer needed within the reservoir. Whereas on the Cook Inlet, you'll see we get a lot of more exploration wells, we get smaller pools, smaller developments, and operators tend to drill their wells one at a time. They don't necessarily have a full plan of development from day one. And so those are the cases where we tend to run into a multiple interwell spacing exception cases. Does that answer your question, Representative Hannon?
Yes.
Thank you, Ms. Chmielewski and Representative Hannon. And for the record, McKay, Kronk, and Gillum have joined us at 1:33. Any other questions from committee members in regards to House Bill 349 and the presentation from AOGCC? Seeing or hearing none, Mr. Price, I just wanted to confer with you as far as, you know, I'm on board with making sure that there's not too much bureaucracy in a process, but I also believe that there needs to be a little as far as keeping intact checks and balances, making sure the public's involved in what's going on, potentially in their front yard, backyard, or living room. So can you give me an assurance that as 349 potentially becomes law, that we're not skirting that checks and balance at all?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Jeremy Price at the AOGCC. I believe we have online from Department of Natural Resources, Graham. And something I'd like to point out is when we, by the time this issue comes to the AOGCC and we're holding hearing on spacing exceptions, this is a very narrow, very targeted, very technical, and very specific hearing that's focused on this information. In the last number of years, at least that I've been around, and Commissioner Chmielewski can chime in, but the questions that have arisen, and they are very few and far between, but once in a while we'll get a question from a homeowner that saw our public notice and they have a concern about noise. And that's completely outside of the scope of our authority. and outside of the scope of the hearing. And so there's nothing we can do about a concern like that. Those issues are raised elsewhere. And DNR has a very extensive process where there are multiple opportunities for the public to engage before development occurs and long before a permit drill is submitted to us. So I can assure you that we are not skirting the public process by passing this legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Price. Mr. Smith?
For the record, my name is Graham Smith. I'm Petroleum Land Manager for Department of Natural Resources, Division of Oil and Gas. And yeah, I'd be happy to verify everything Commissioner Price just said. Our public processes in DNR are many and robust, and the passage of this bill would not affect those. And I'd be happy to speak in detail about any of those stages of the development, but just a brief summary would be that I'm sure this body and this committee in particular is very familiar with the Article 8, Section 10 that says no disposals of leases of state land or interest therein shall be made without prior public notice and other safeguards of the public interest as may be prescribed. And that goes from the best interest finding before we have the lease sale all the way up until termination of the lease or the unit, with multiple public processes in the middle there. We also have, in addition to the constitutional obligation, we've got statutory obligation to conduct public notices at various stages. And there's actually case law that dictates that each phase of development has its own public process. So we do a lot of public notices. DNR doesn't have an official position on this bill, but I can tell you it will not affect any of those processes.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. I will sleep easy tonight. And then just another question on top of that, going down a little bit into authority and permitting. In no way does this piece of legislation affect negatively or positively the permitting authority of any municipality that these well spacing exceptions may be permitted, either on the North Slope or in the Cook Inlet. And I don't know if that's a question for Mr. Price or...
I can take it on, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, there's no impact on from this legislation on that issue. Again, Jeremy Price with AOGCC.
Thank you for that. Any other questions from the committee members before we roll into public testimony on 349? Seeing or hearing none, we'll do that just now. Public testimony on House Bill 349 is now open. Can you clarify if there's anybody online? Okay, thank you. Is there anybody in the room willing to testify publicly on House Bill 349, willing or wanting? Seeing or hearing none, we'll now close public testimony on House Bill 349. Any further questions from committee members? Yeah, you got it pretty good there, Representative Rauscher. We're going to set this bill aside. I'd like to thank Representative Rauscher and his team for giving us an introductory presentation on the matter. And the plan is to bring it up again on Friday, so if there are any amendments that you'd like to offer or entertain, please get with my office by tomorrow at 5 o'clock. With that, we'll pivot into our next order of business. That's House Bill 171. This is our third hearing on House Bill 171, PFAS, PFOA bill. Our goal here today is to bring the bill up to date based on the changes made in the other body and the other resources committee, and take testimony from the sponsor and affected agencies. And first order of business, Representative Hannum has asked us to adopt a CS to House Bill 171 that matches the version that's currently in the works on the other side. Rep. Hopkins, do you have a motion?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. I move that we adopt committee substitute for House Bill 171, Work Draft 32-LS0788/I as our working document.
Hearing a motion, no objections. It is so moved. Representative Hannum, welcome again on House Bill 171. And Mr. Clark, if you can please put your name on the record and begin your public test or your presentation on the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for hearing it again. And it's been a while, so let me just remind you that the goal and what House Bill 171 does is sets in statute health protective levels for drinking water that limit PFAS and PFOA compounds. one of the major changes, and I will turn it over to my chief of staff to walk through any other changes, but one of the areas that the committee substitute has done is removed the blood test collection and monitoring. The bill continues to affirm that the polluter pays and they are liable. The liability for the pollution remains with the polluter. That there is remains an exemption for the oil and gas industry. There remains an exemption for use until there is an alternative that is acceptable by the state fire marshal. And of course, it, you know, the nature of oil and gas fires is they burn hot and they burn long. And so PFAS, PFOA, AFFF foams are the best use of it. The majority of PFAS, PFOA pollution in Alaska is not from actual fire response, but from required testing example at airports. And as we know, learned, it's a compound that does not dissipate, does not dilute, but it does migrate in the water column. And that's what has occurred across Alaska, is that it has migrated from sites that were required to deploy it into drinking water systems. And it is a very toxic to humans chemical compound that contributes to low birth weight, thyroid disease, and a really horrifying list of cancers that it's a high contributor to. Mr. Clark, were there other things that you wanted to make sure we talked about in the differences in the new bill or remind them of? And I forgot to say thank you, and I'm Representative Hannon.
Mr. Thank Chairman, for the record, Tim Clark, staff to Representative Hannon. Other than the removal of the blood testing requirements, the only other change is a updating of the effective date of the bill from January 1st, 2022 to January 1st, 2023. That's pretty much the extent of it.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Any initial questions from committee members before we go to the invited testimony, Representative Hopkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if this is a good question for invited testimony, please tell me to wait. So you said the polluter, the original polluter, would be responsible for the cleanup or the remediation of it. Is that the original polluter, as I just said, or is it the current landowner, or if it is an ongoing process, who would be held responsible? So as my example, up in Fairbanks, looking at a sulfalane issue that we have in the chemical spills, there's been a fair bit of court cases between the original people who built the refinery and then the company that purchased the refinery after the spill had happened. And there was a lot of court cases trying to figure out who would be liable. Would it be the original person who did the pollution, or would it be who then was the owner when the pollution was discovered?
Mr. Chairman, and thank you for that question. And Mr. Hopkins, you'll know because you're married to a lawyer that I'm not really punting on this, but you said those magic words. There's been a lot of litigation, and so I'm going to ease my armchair and say, in that specific case, the lawyers are going to have to fight it out because I do not know.
Understandable. And follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up, Representative Hopkins.
Thank you. And then if the original polluter is a governmental entity such as the Department of Defense, another issue in my neck of the woods for PFAS issues, would they be the responsible polluters?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hopkins and Representative Hannon. I know we've got DEC and Senior Assistant Attorney General on the line, and we'll have them testifying a little later in the committee process. So I think as long as they're taking notes and can try to answer some of those questions in their presentation, that should be streamlining things. Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Chairman Puckett. I was just wondering to follow up on Representative Hopkins' question there. Is there anything in the bill that dictates the answer to his first question? In other words, I know what you said, you'll have to fight it out in court, but is there anything that points one way or other in the bill?
Go ahead.
For the record, Tim Clark, staff to Representative Hannon. Mr. Chairman, Representative Rauscher, the premise, you could say the foundational premise for liabilities in the bill is the concept that the polluter pays. So the simplest answer would be that the liability would rest with the entity that that caused the discharge of the pollutant into the environment.
Follow-up, Representative Rush.
So if the federal government was to okay the use of, in, say, an airport, who's the polluter?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rauscher, the FAA for a very long period of time, up until the present, required airports to train with PFAS bearing foams on a regular basis, and conceivably, it seems to me that the FAA would be the liable entity.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Gillum.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, my issues, I had someone come to my office and talking about this, and here in Juneau, you have an airport, and so what I've heard is you have over 5,000 items that this PFAS is in, cardboard, styrofoam containers. So you have a dump within a mile or two of the airport, and it has been known to rain in Juneau sometimes. So when it rains, it washes that down into the water table. So how would they know if this PFAS came from the airport or the dump? So who would be liable there? Also, it's my understanding is there's a channel or something that this sludge from a dump washes out into the channel. And I'm sure it's taking it with it. So that's taking this PFAS out to the crab and the shrimp and the fish. So what, there again, where's the liability?
So I guess I want to just start and separate PFAS foam and PFAS in things. So if you wear a Gore-Tex jacket, there's PFAS in it. If you use Glide dental floss, there's PFAS in it. Most fast food containers have PFAS. This bill is not addressing those. Some states' legislation are, especially in manufacturing states. In Alaska, our water column issues are related to the disbursement of the foam. Now, the Juneau landfill, I guess as a citizen here, I'd like to hear from that person. We've been assured that our landfill has a liner in it and it does not leach into the water table. And we have it's all on wetlands there where the mountain dump, we call it. If you want to see eagles, it's where you go. But it's the PFAS foam in Alaska, it's primarily associated with use at airports that was mandated testing. And when we talk about the liability, what we're talking about is the cleanup and providing clean drinking water. In the specific example of the Juneau Airport, the thing that it's on a saltwater area, it's not where we get our drinking water. Our drinking water is coming from actually Mount Juneau. So in that case, although there is probably, because at every airport there has, but what I have described is our airport's wetland flushes twice a day, and no one's getting their drinking water from it. But in Gustavus, a community in my district just to the west of us, the flattest section of southeast Alaska we have, the water table is there, and there is no community water system, and a number of wells have been polluted. It is one of the communities. It is the community that brought me to learning about PFAS because the school well is polluted with PFAS from the airport leaching out of it. And the Department of Transportation has now for 5 years provided that community to the citizens whose wells were polluted from the PFAS plume at the Gustavus Airport. DOT has been providing them drinking water and an alternative source. And the cleanup and mitigation of it is ongoing, and DOT with DEC have been taking the responsibility for it.
That's Vice Representative Gillum. Thank you. Representative Rocha.
Thank you for the chance to one more follow-up. As I just read this page 2, line 18 through 827, and if I can, I'd just like to read it. A person who causes a fire that results in the release of a firefighting substance containing this perfluoroalkyl, excuse me if I tripped over the word substance or perfluoroalkyl, the substance is liable for the cost of providing drinking water and drinking water testing. And so they are not the one that released it under what we had just talked about before, but they are liable for some of the causes that may have happened afterward. And then part B, a person who extinguishes a fire by releasing a firefighting substance that contains this substance and this polyfluorocarb substance is not liable for the costs of that drinking water. So it kind of contradicts somewhat those who released it and what we were just talking about. I wonder if you could just speak to that for a minute.
Chair Plutkatuk, Representative Rauscher, when it refers to a person in that paragraph, most likely that would be a company in the way that, you know, in U.S. law, companies are persons. The difference being that, you know, if an entity were found to be having caused a fire where PFAS was used in putting out that fire, the person who caused the fire would be liable. The next paragraph is differentiating in that we certainly don't want any fire departments who are forced to use these substances in order to put out a fire, save lives, to be held liable because of the circumstances they found themselves in.
All right, well, I thank you for the clarification and being able to let us understand that better. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Rush. Representative McKay.
Thank you, Chairman Pukatuk, and through the chair, just to follow up on my colleague. You know, I can think of a lot of examples where a fire could be caused that could be an accident. Let's say I'm learning to fly a plane at Gustavus Airport, and I have an engine failure. And I crash land, you know, on the runway, and the trucks come running out, and they hit it with, and I'm on fire, and they hit it with the PFAS because that's what they've got. So I'm the pilot in training, and I'm going to be held liable. I mean, that seems to be a little bit of a stretch in line 18. This is probably getting into legal liability law here, but I can think of a lot of examples where it's not intentional that I caused the fire. It's an accident or a... You know, I tip over a drum of Avgas in the shop at the airport, and I don't know, some guy's smoking a cigarette, right? And it's an accident. You can't connect liability to an unintentional, accidental act. So that's what would bring questions to my mind for line 18. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Can I use our lifeline? Because
I was just going to say maybe we move on with the presentation.
Well, so we're going to address some of these. And she's so the staff to Senator Keel, who has the companion legislation, who happens to also be an attorney and a chemist.
Ah, all right. Lifeline, please approach the hot seat. you can identify yourself on the record and begin to try to unpack some of the line of questioning from the members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Kathy Schlingheid, staff to Senator Keel. Great questions from the committee. So the liability provisions in this are designed to match.
Ma'am, can you pull the mic a little closer, please?
Of course. I'm sorry,
thank
sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, in response to Representative McKay, the liability provisions are designed to match the existing DEC rules about liability. So with all of DEC's hazardous substances, and I know the department can speak more about this, the polluter pays or the spiller pays, and that includes for accidental releases. So if someone were to spill a carcinogen into the environment, even though it was an accident, they would still be liable for the cleanup. They wouldn't have criminal liability because there's not that intent, but they would have civil liability as the responsible party. And this bill was designed to match that general scheme where the polluter does pay. It adds in some protections that don't exist in current law. So, for example, a volunteer fire department in current law actually is responsible when they use PFAS-containing foam or spray anything else when they're fighting a fire. This gives them a liability shield that they wouldn't otherwise have because there's concern about the ability for volunteer fire departments and others to be able to pay for this. But it doesn't create a new type of liability.
Follow-up. So if I'm to understand this correctly, we have PFAS at airports right now in Alaska.
Mr. Chair, in response, yes, sir.
Okay. So we got PFAS out there right now. And the fire department people at the airport are shielded from liability to use that material if there's a fire.
Mr. Chair, if there's an actual fire, this would give them a liability shield, but not for a training or accidental release.
Okay, so again, if it's an accident, I think it's unfair if there's a if I'm piloting an aircraft, and the engine fails and I crash on the runway and they come out and spray me down with PFAS, you know, the saving of human life is more important, frankly, than the groundwater. So I'm not quite understanding why there's so much liability affixed to an accidental situation where the material, you know, I don't have any choice that they've got PFAS. That's what they're using. That's what they've got. So me as the pilot who's coming in, you know, I can't say, well, I'm sorry, I'm going to crash, guys, but don't use that PFAS. Let me burn to death. I mean, no, that's not, I don't think that's right. Doesn't make sense to me.
But I think, Mr. McKay, I will tell you that Gustavus provides us the great scenario and bad example because we have both DOT being liable for the drinking water from the airport practice discharge, but the Gustavus Volunteer Fire Department, in responding to a real fire, did use PFAS, and they are being held, and DEC is now in a multi-year battle to deem them responsible for the pollution they caused. So currently, volunteer fire departments discharging it are liable. In response to a fire, this bill will create a protection for them in that, if you're responding to a fire. But right now, DC for 4 years has been trying to collect from the volunteer fire department in Gustavus for their response in using PFAS, but we'll go even close one step further, from the truck that was donated to them from the state to their volunteer fire department, but was full of PFAS foam. And they use, it's a second class city. They don't have the, yeah, so.
Thank you, Representative. We've got a few more questions and comments, but I really do think that it would be wise of us to hear from the invited testimony folks and Department of Environment and Conservation. So. Representative Shrag, Representative Rauscher. So Representative Hannon, Mr. Clark. And sorry, I didn't catch your name.
Kathy Schlingheid, sir.
What was the last name?
Schlingheid, sir.
Schlingheid. Schlingheid. Well, Ms. Schlingheid, thank you. Representative Hannon, who would you like to address the committee next? Is it Mr. Chris Halladick?
Yes.
Okay.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. We can hear you well. If you could please put your name on the record.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Chris Laddick, and I'm testifying on behalf of myself. I was the former EPA Region 10 Administrator, also former Commissioner of Commerce and City Manager for over 27 years in the state of Alaska. I'm testifying in support of the bill, 171, because I think it's a good first step. Today's discussion has been a good discussion about some of the complicating issues with PFAS, or what EPA calls forever chemicals. They are in the process of developing what's called an MCL, mean contaminant level for drinking water, and supposed to be done by the summer of 2023. There's nothing to say that the state can't set levels of their own and then adjust them if they wish in the future, or you can keep them less than what the EPA has developed for an MCL, which in itself is a complicated process with that involves toxicologists, etc. I believe they're working on 22 chemicals in the PFAS, PFOA family of some over 4,500 chemicals. Liability is an issue, as has been stated by the representative that brought the bill today. And I just think it's an important first step to work these issues out as you go. You'll need legal interpretation on that liability issue. And I know that the process will go forward, but I just think it's an important first step. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hadlick. Any questions or comments for Mr. Hadlick?
Do you want to do more before we start asking questions?
Yeah, actually, I've asked DEC representatives to be in attendance today to give a little presentation on what it would mean to the department as far as putting it into work and for back and forth questions, obviously. And I'm sure they've been listening and taking notes on the discussion we've had thus far. So unless there's anything else, either Representative Hannon or Mr. Hadlick would like to apprise the committee of, we can move on to that. Thank you, Mr. Hadlick. Online, as I said, we've got DEC representatives and Department of Law representatives, Tiffany Larson, who's the Director of Spills Prevention and Response, and also Jennifer Curry, who's the Senior Assistant Attorney General. If you folks can please put yourself on the record, begin your presentation, and as mentioned, we'll take questions as they come up, and hopefully you can walk us through unpacking some of the scenarios that were given and what this means if this bill were to become law, or if there's opportunities for amendments to effectuate the committee's wants. So, Ms. Larson.
Good afternoon, representatives. For the record, Tiffany Larson, Division Director, Spill Prevention and Response. I hope you all received our prepared statements in advance and had a chance to review them. I'll go over them here. They are, for the most part, identical to what was provided in Senate Finance. However, they did contemplate the previous version of the bill before the committee substitute adopted today. So some of the points are no longer valid, and I will try and skip them. So PFAS is a family of chemicals. There's 5,000 to 10,000 man-made chemicals, carbon bonded to fluorine, which is one of the strongest bonds known to exist. They're water, oil, and heat resistant, water soluble, persistent in the environment, and bioaccumulate. While the department has concerns about the content of the bill, we appreciate Representative Hannon bringing attention to this important subject. To the question, what has DEC done in the absence of legislation to protect Alaskans and the environment? Alaska proactively listed PFOA and PFOS as hazardous substances. In 2016, Alaska was one of the first states to promulgate soil and groundwater cleanup levels for two PFAS compounds. In 2019, we incorporated through our technical memo the lifetime health advisory of 70 parts per trillion for PFOA or PFOS, individual or combined. And what that number means is simply the threshold for when a responsible party is required to provide alternative drinking water. And then beginning in 2018, the Department of Environmental Conservation and Department of Transportation have been voluntarily testing drinking water wells at the airports that have been required to use aqueous film forming foam, or AFFF. And that effort continues through this day. As part of that effort, we implemented expedited procedures to sample wells that we suspected of contamination, and where drinking water impacts were found, alternative drinking water has been provided. We also issued 2 state permits for thermal remediation that's protective of human health and the environment, consistent with developed testing requirements for limits and emissions. So EPA is actively working on this issue, the issue of 5 to 10,000 compounds of PFAS, by developing a strategic roadmap that they published in October of 2021. They've also sent forward through their science advisory board for PFOS and PFOA and had them review the existing research. And what the result of that science advisory board will be is to be released actually in May. So we're just a few weeks out from expecting to see the results of that review board. And we're anticipating that that review board will set a lower lifetime health advisory, that number I gave you earlier of 70 parts per trillion. We expect that to go down. And we expect it to be reduced by approximately an order of magnitude. So from 70 parts per trillion down to 7 parts per trillion or lower. Additionally, in fall of this year, they're expected to issue proposed rulemaking for National Primary Drinking Water Act regulations and finalizing or promulgating that rule in fall of next year, so 2023. In the winter of this year, we expect EPA to publish ambient water quality criteria. And also, they're looking at identifying categories of PFAS regulating on an individual compound basis. As we can see here with the legislation, takes time and effort. And there might be better suited categories to regulate them on a familial basis versus an individual basis. And so research efforts are going in towards that. By summer 2023, we expect that EPA will have published a final rule for under CERCLA as a designation for PFOA and PFOS. And with that, I'm going to pass it off to my co-presenter from the Department of Law. As we previously stated, we need to get our lawyers involved. So Jen Curry.
Thank you, Ms.
Good
Wilson.
Afternoon. Oh, sorry.
Oh, no, I was just going to say let's do a sound check and we can put you on the record and have you do your presentation.
Sure. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you wonderfully.
My name is Jennifer Curry. I'm the Chief Assistant Attorney General for the Environmental Section at the Alaska Department of Law. I have reviewed the legislation and had some concerns. And I'll go through the concerns that I had for you. This was also provided as testimony in the Senate hearing. There are 2 distinct ways that the Department of Environmental Conservation can identify a substance as hazardous. First, DEC can make a determination based on the definition of hazardous substance contained in statute. Second, it can list the hazardous substance in its promulgated regulations. When DEC makes a determination that a substance, especially an emerging contaminant, is hazardous according to the definition only and not by regulation, responsible parties have tried to evade liability by improperly arguing that the determination is not valid because it is not in regulation. If this bill is enacted, there is concern that liable parties will try to evade liability by arguing that PFAS, that other emerging contaminants are not hazardous substances because they are not named in statute. The language of the bill is also unclear as to whether the bill is defining hazardous substances under state law to include PFAS. It's only referred to as a substance. DEC liability statutes only impose joint and several liability on releases of hazardous substances. Section C of Part 350 of the bill requires DEC to accept certain amounts of PFAS each year, all of which must be disposed of by DEC. If at any point in the future the PFAS disposal site either has a release or receives a determination that is not appropriate for PFAS disposal, the site will be deemed a contaminated site, likely under state or federal law. Because DEC is the entity that disposed of PFAS at the site, the state will be held jointly and severally liable for addressing the contamination at that site. Another issue is that in Part 345B, it names the federal government as liable if it requires the use of a PFAS substance. However, any provision that names the federal government liable under a state statute would be subject to challenge unless there's a valid waiver of sovereign immunity. The United States has sovereign immunity for lawsuits just as the state does. For a waiver of sovereign immunity to be valid, Congress must be very specific about what it intends to waive, or courts will hold the waiver has not occurred. In order to enforce 345B, the state would likely have to enter costly litigation without a likelihood of success to attempt to hold the federal government liable. Those are my prepared statements. I know that there have been a number of questions. Not sure where to start. Oh, let me hand it back to Tiffany Larson. I think she has a few more comments.
Thank you, Ms. Curry. Ms. Larson.
Thank you. For the record, Tiffany Larson, Division Director, Spill Prevention and Response. So continuing, what challenges exist for DEC with implementing the bill as written? Currently, there's not an existing database in the state of Alaska where we know all aqueous film-forming foam has been used. So we'd have to build that out, do the research, and find it. There's significant liability to the state, as Jen just mentioned, and for ultimate disposal. And there's not a current mechanism, skipping the bullet about blood monitoring that you have in your packets. There's not a current mechanism by which DEC can accept, handle, or dispose of any amount of PFAS-containing firefighting substances. Additionally, the federal permitting for thermal remediation doesn't change the monitoring requirements, and only adds time and expense for those permit applicants. The minimal release language for thermal remediation requires contract development of a numerical pollutant limit and special procedures more stringent than federal requirements on a timeline, and that's on a timeline ahead of EPA and the science. So I think I'll close out with the following thoughts. DEC has the necessary authority and has used it to require responsible parties to respond to PFAS contamination and to regulate hazardous substances. To statutorily declare a substance as hazardous could jump ahead of the science and takes that decision-making out of the hands of DEC's technical staff. We understand the concern that the public has regarding PFAS and the desire for clear lines of what is safe and not safe. The scientific community is still working to determine the critical levels of PFAS in our blood, drinking water, and our bodies. And this bill doesn't make that process happen any faster. And with that, I am available for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Larson and Ms. Curry. I know we've got a few questions here, and I just want to make sure everybody's aware that we've got Randy Bates with the Director of Water Division and Christina Carpenter and Jason Olds, DEC, to answer some of the more technical questions. So unless there are more questions for the bill sponsors specifically, maybe I'd ask those three to come up and be able to dive into some of the details of the questions posed by Representative McKay, Rauscher, and I'm sure Shragi will have some more technical questions. So as that transition happens, Representative McKay, I know that you earlier in the queue had asked some pretty technical questions. I'm not sure if the members that are coming up to the table heard them, if they'd like them restated, or if you can help them in helping you answer some of those things.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, well, maybe you fellows need to introduce yourselves. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Happy to do so. Chair Puckduck, members of the committee, good afternoon. Randy Bates, Director of Water, Department of Environmental Conservation.
Chair, this is Jason Olds. I'm with the Division of Air Quality.
Yeah, thank you. And for your information, Representative McKay and others, Christina Carpenter with the Department of Health, Environmental Health, and DEC is online also. So.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually worked in hazardous waste cleanup for a couple of years, and I have a master's in environmental engineering, so have some familiarity with these topics and certainly understand the seriousness of a groundwater contamination, and plumes are very difficult problems to solve, and I have a great appreciation for that. I guess I would just, as I read through the bill, First of all, I guess on page 2, line 8 through 16, we're identifying concentrations in parts per trillion, which is a very, very small amount to be able to detect. And we're giving it an exact number. For example, 816, 651. It seems like this would be like us passing a law that the speed limit on the Parks Highway is 64.3876 miles per hour, nothing more, nothing less. It seems like maybe we're being too precise, too prescriptive, because these values can change as the EPA and other agencies do more testing. Mm-hmm. And so we would have to revisit these numbers from time to time. I don't know if that – I think the DEC can set these numbers independently of the legislature. That's just one observation I have. And then I was thinking about some examples of where it's going to assign liability to potential accidents. I was thinking, well, like I used one earlier of a, you know, guy loses his engine in his plane and he crash lands on the runway and he's on fire. PFAS is the only thing the fire department's got. And it's going to be his fault. I don't know. That seems like a stretch to me, but I'm not a lawyer. The other example I had was, okay, let's say there's a drum of avgas and the forklift driver accidentally puts a fork through a drum of avgas and it ignites. It's an accident. I don't think the forklift driver is liable for the groundwater contamination. It seems like a stretch, but those are a couple of my observations of some of the content. So with that, I'll close. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative McKay. And if you folks like to take a stab at some of those points and questions and examples.
I'll tell you, Mr. Chair, Representative McKay, I represent the Division of Water, and I'm happy to address those particular issues, Clean Water Act. I know that Director Larson is on, and we have Director Carpenter who can also address these. These are very specific drinking water provisions, which is a little bit different than clean water provisions. I'm happy to give you my perspective. I happen to be here in person. But if they can speak to those, I'm happy to respect that and defer.
Okay, back to the folks online.
For the record, Tiffany Larson, Division Director, Spill Prevention and Response. Okay, there was a lot of questions there through the chair. Let's start with the prescriptive limits question about these numbers seem very specific, and that's akin to writing a speed limit sign of 64.8 miles per hour. While the state of Alaska didn't originate the limits in this legislation and isn't out of kind or somehow different from the way drinking water standards are established in the orders of magnitude and the numbers you're seeing here, they usually are prescriptive. That being said, the origin of these limits, I suppose the bill sponsor probably has a better awareness than I do. The other question, which was that? Oh, liability, accidental liability, and if someone... Thanks. Department of Law has just come back online, so I'm going to throw this to the lawyers again.
Hi, Jennifer Curry with the Alaska Department of Law. Representative McKay, you're absolutely right. The environmental statutes for liability don't take into account accidents. They are no fault. There is some confusion with the bill because Alaska's liability statute for contamination is 4603A22, and it establishes four different categories of people liable jointly and severally. So each one is responsible for the fault all themselves. So if you had two people liable and one went bankrupt, the one that was left would be responsible for all of it. That's joint and several liability. The legislation establishes sort of two new categories of liability, and it doesn't note whether they're jointly and severally liable in conjunction with 822, or not. And it also, as I said before, doesn't establish that PFAS are hazardous substances, which is required for 822. So in your two examples, when there are accidents, though the traditional liability for contamination does not take into account your mental state.
Thank you, Ms. Curry and Representative McKay for the line of questioning. We've got Representative Rauscher's question that he had asked earlier that I'm not sure we got a response or answer to, and then we'll pivot over to Representative Shragi, then Gillum, according to the queue, Representative Rauscher.
That's your question you're referring to, so I have a different one.
You've got the queue. Take advantage of it.
Thank you. So I guess when you look at these parts per million, I just want to know how or what are limits. The data, what did we use for the data limits? And since the report is not out yet, and it won't be out till May, how do we acquire those?
Mr. Chairman, they came from a Michigan study group, Michigan the Michigan PFAS Science Advisory Working Group. Michigan's had the unlucky position of being one of the leading states with their PFAS pollution from both being a manufacturing and a state with lots of it. That's where it came from. So last year when we first introduced the bill, we shared that research with you. Happy to give you the studies kit.
Okay. So follow up, just how old is it and why did you choose them?
Michigan started the leading state on state establishing standards. The report that came is based in 2019.
Mm-hmm.
From still, I introduced in 2020. And we're still with it.
Okay. And through the chair, I'll follow up there. There will any idea where, how we're going to, the volume of 25 gallons each year from every entity, whether it could be oil company or companies, firefighting outfit or whatever, that we have an idea of the volume that we're going to be housing, warehousing every year?
We don't. It is limited to 25 per year. Now, I guess I want to just footnote that DOT has identified 34 airports that they have PFAS aqueous foam at. That's where the study, where the state started researching, testing. And so we know that we have it at all the state airports that it was required to be at. And, you know, sort of my belief is it would be better to move it from diverse locations where a forklift driver might puncture it, so at least you have it in a more centralized location to be collected and disposed of or monitored.
And through the chair, I just wonder, do you have any idea of the volume here we're talking about between all the fire departments, the oil companies?
We don't.
Okay. And then another thing is there seems to be this, chemical makeup, 50 to 10,000 compounds, of which I believe some plastics and a lot of plastics have that in there. So how are we differentiating contamination here when we're looking at chemical makeup being brought down to the umpteen thousand different compounds?
Well, that's, again, the legislation that we have is focusing on the PFAS and PFOA compounds used in AFFF, the firefighting foam, not in the plastics, not in Gore-Tex, because in Alaska, we're not manufacturing sites for any of those. And although, you know, this is one of the issues I've learned about it, probably all have some PFAS in our bloodstream, depending on how much Gore-Tex, how much Teflon pan we cooked on. It's not in our, for most of it's not in our drinking water on a daily basis. And this legislation is focused on the AFFF compounds that are in the firefighting foam.
And through the chair, for this round, do you think that the data that you'll find in the report that's coming out in May will be a lot different or exactly the same, or why not, and how do you come up with that?
Do I think that the EPA will have research that correlates to what Alaska's clean drinking water standards are? No. I don't think they are working fast enough.
I think they have to work on a national level to address the hundreds of PFAS compounds. And that's sort of the impetus for the bill is we've been waiting on the feds, the EPA, to address clean drinking water standards, and the EPA is not doing it in a fast enough way to address the safety and security and health protection of Alaskans.
See, we've all got a bone to pick with the feds.
That's right, and we've never been shy about suing them. So I'm, you know, and drinking water standards, I think, is a viable element to make sure we are protecting Alaskans.
Well, it seems like the feds are maintaining a level at the airports that they have to maintain, and then all the other entities are looking to that level, and they're all saying, well, then I guess it's okay, and they're utilizing it. And so then to put this, I believe you have some retro in here, it kind of worries me that everybody was boning off of that, and then to be now held retro liable, I guess I'm worried.
Thank you, Representative Rauscher and Representative Hannon. Representative Schrage.
Thank you, Chair Buckduck. So I wanted to ask, there's been some, I think, concern about, you know, we have many different PFAS chemicals, some of which are in firefighting foam, some of which are in Gore-Tex and other products. I mean, when I think about it, I think of it like petroleum products. We've got petroleum products in our computers and our boots and everything else, and there's kind of the raw material. If you dump it into a lake or into a well, it's going to cause all sorts of issues. If you dump the little plastic toy dump truck, which is made with the same oil products, it's not going to just instantly pollute the well if I drop that little toy in that well at the same time. Is that kind of the – should I think about PFAS in the same way where, yeah, they're similar chemicals and they're found in different products, but those products that they're found in aren't all the same and their ability to pollute aren't the same. Is that kind of the right way to think about it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrage, again, I'll defer a little bit to Tiffany here. She's our lead on this. I'll just –
Thank you. For the record, Director Larson, Spill Prevention and Response. Representative Schrage, through the chair, in your example, if you dumped a small amount of petroleum into a well, what does that result in contamination? And I think the answer to that question isn't quite as simple. It is, we talk about pollution in terms of the product release relative to the environment it's released to. And so when we talk about these limits and we talk about the concentrations in the type of environment, soil or groundwater or drinking water, it is specific to what we're talking about. So in this instance, in the easy example is the legislation before you, you'll see the limits of, 420 parts per trillion for PFOS, so that's specific. So if you reach that or exceed it, that's your drinking water limit, and what this legislation says, you wouldn't want to have anything above that in your body. Below that's okay.
So it just depends. Could I maybe clarify my question a little bit? Sure. Yeah, thank you, through the chair. So, and thanks, Tiffany, for addressing this. I guess my question is, I mean, we had the question earlier about, you know, we have a dump that may or may not have a liner. I suspect does have a liner, but products that have the PFAS chemicals bound into them as part of the production process or that utilize the PFAS chemicals, they're not just leaching into the water at the same – they're not impacting the water system in the same way that the firefighting foams, which have essentially a – not soluble, but the
PFAS – they're aqueous.
The PFAS chemicals are able to quickly disperse into that water system. Am I right to think that when it's bound into a product – We're pretty sure that's not the source of the PFAS contamination.
Representative Schrage, through the chair, that is correct. Yes, the principal source of PFAS in our groundwater in the state of Alaska is from AFFF release, or aqueous film forming foams. Correct.
Okay, thank you. And then the other kind of question I had as I was thinking about all this is along Rep. McKay's questioning about the pilot or the knocking over the barrel of avgas, and it made me realize I don't exactly know what the liability, for, you know, if I am out at a Klutna Lake and I accidentally knock a barrel of some substance out of my truck into the lake, am I going to be held? I mean, I know it's an accident. If I accidentally run someone over with my car, I'm still going to, you know, face charges and repercussions for that, right? I don't just get to say, yeah, it was an accident. Sorry, guys. I mean, is it the same thing if I go to...
Was it really an accident?
You know, if I go out to a Clutona Lake and I accidentally knock a barrel of some hazardous substance, PFAS firefighting foam, maybe that's a bad example because the statutes aren't very clear around that, but some other known contaminant that we don't want in our drinking water, I knock that into the lake. Am I going to be responsible for that? Or I mean, what does current statute say about my accident?
Representative Schrege, through the chair, yes, you will. You will be held liable under 4603-822.
Okay. Thank you. That's very helpful as I just think about what we're considering here. I just wanted to clarify for myself. Thank you very much. That was helpful.
Thank you, Ms. Curry. And I think it goes another layer into the onion as far as the line of questioning from Representative McKay, because like he's saying, do you tell the fire department, just let it burn. I don't want the PFAS contamination. Just let it burn. I'll work with the insurance company. I think that's the discrepancy that we're seeing as far as the liability goes. I totally understand the idea of making sure that volunteer fire departments aren't liable, but now we're kicking the liability over to somebody who you don't know. I mean, do you sign a waiver before you put out the fire, authorizing that you'll be responsible for the... Yeah, assess the situation. Exactly. So I think that's the layer deeper that we're trying to understand here as we have this discussion. We actually had Representative Schrage, if you were finished.
Well, let's go to
okay. Gillum. Representative Gillum.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Going to the numbers, if you delete this down, you're at one part for $15.6 billion. That just, to me, is mind-boggling because H2S at 6 parts per million, and this is, you know, 70 parts per trillion, and it breaks down to 1 part for $15 billion. I don't understand how the amount of water you would have to drink. You're almost drinking 42,000 gallons of water a day. I just can't wrap my head around this. So it's basically just a comment. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Gillum. Representative Roush, did you have a question?
Yeah, I just had one more question. Thank you. To the previous question before and the answer, basically, it says PFAS substance. I mean, it says PFAS substances. It's not really talking about AFFF. If it was, it would be listed that way, but it's not. It just keeps repeating substances. And so I guess I'm trying to get a understanding of the generics here versus absolutes and how we're looking at that legally.
Representative Hannon.
Well, and I'll take a stab, or maybe I should.
We've got like 6 people that you can pitch to.
Yeah. There are hundreds of PFAS compounds and components. This legislation is focusing on the 7 that are the primary components in AFFF, which is the firefighting foam.
Why do you keep saying that? But it doesn't say that.
So
on page 2, where the substances are listed, those 7 compounds, those are them.
Yeah, I just like said, these are AFF components.
Well,
sorry.
As you understand, ledge legal, yeah. We don't write our laws in colloquial speak. Yeah. And with hazardous substances, they've asked to be very specific.
Mr. Clark, I saw you seeking recognition.
For the record, Tim Clark, staff to Representative Hannon. I don't have anything particular to add to this exchange. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Any other...
I just think it's going to have to visit... Ledge legal here a little and try to figure out why why it's written the way it is, because it looks to me like...
No, I understand the concern as far as opening a can of worms, not specific to AFFF. Over in Section 1 on 4603340, like you're saying, it doesn't say anything about firefighting substances until you get over to page 2, line 18, where it actually says firefighters, substances containing perfluorocarbonyl substance and polyfluorocarbonyl substance. So I think there's a general understanding amongst the committee that PFAS, PFO is an issue. It's just a matter of how we're going to find a way to address the issue. And that's where we have kind of differences and things that we need to work on with the bill sponsor, both here and in the other body. So, Representative Shragi.
Thank you, Chair Buckduck. Not sure who to send this to, but maybe to the lawyer online. I guess I'm curious thinking about this notion that if you cause a fire that requires PFAS firefighting foams to be used to put it out, Rep. McKay brings up this interesting idea of a private pilot, and that seems like a very genuine concern. As a private pilot myself, it's a hard decision. Do I risk not having the fire put out and burning up or polluting drinking water for a couple thousand people or more? I don't know. It's especially if it's a permanent chemical that permanently harms that groundwater. I wanted to think maybe more of what I was thinking about, maybe what the intent of that was. I doubt the private pilot was who was in mind when this liability was envisioned. And I'm just curious, I think about chemical production facilities. I think we've seen pictures of, these giant fires in port facilities and in other chemical plants in the lower 48 and in other countries. And I'm just curious, is this a novel idea? If you have a company that deals with hazardous materials all the time that maybe requires some sort of special remediation if there's a spill or special treatment if there's a fire or some sort of special circumstances, do we have other laws like this on the books to where maybe you have to have some sort of special liability insurance recognizing that the cleanup is going to be massive? I mean, how novel is this? Can you shed any insight on that to me? Thank you.
Representative Shargi, through the chair, just to be clear, 4603-822 that establishes liability for the release of hazardous substances does not have this as a category of people that are liable. This is a new category of people that are liable under state law. I don't know if other states have also established the person who causes the fire as a person liable, either regular liability or joint and several liability. Does that answer your question?
I think I'm just going to have to work on this one offline. Yeah. Thank you, Chair.
I think there's plenty of work that we can do offline together, either with the bill sponsor or with the department, to answer some of our specific questions. With that, are there any other questions that maybe aren't so specific? Representative Gillum?
I'm just trying to wrap my head around the numbers.
Representative McKay.
I know that Alaska currently doesn't have a facility to destroy hazardous waste, from what I know. And these types of things have to be shipped to the lower 48 for proper disposal. Is that correct? I think I'm looking at the air quality guy because, you need to destroy, like PCBs, you have to destroy them at like 2,200 degrees for 3 or 5 seconds, very high temperature. And we don't have anything like that in Alaska. It would be helpful if we did, actually. But maybe
through the chair, Representative McKay, we have permitted 2 facilities actually in Alaska that are currently capable of thermally remediating PFAS.
For the record.
For the record.
Yes. Your name?
I'm sorry. For the record, Jason Oles, Air Quality.
Where are those located, Jason?
Through the chair, Representative McKay, currently there is one in Moose Creek between up near North Pole and also another facility at in Valdez.
Okay. Thank you. And I guess just to that discussion point, totally eliminates the PFAS, PFOS, you incinerate it, or I mean, is it caught up in the filters and then you got contaminated filters or what?
Scrubbers.
Chair Pektuk, I believe the number we quoted is a 99.9999% destruction. There's several treatment technologies in the process where it would be captured or other sort of product pollutants like the HF are captured. It's an industrial process that perhaps Representative McKay might be familiar in soil treatment, but there's a lot of controls that go on something like that.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah. Representative Crum.
Thank you, Chair Pekka. Through the chair, so I got a question about Moose Creek. So I think it's a simpler question. So once PFAS are in the water, is that water contaminated forever?
Through the chair, Representative Kronk, I would probably go to one of our other representatives for the drinking water, or I don't know if Mr. Bates can answer that one.
Sure. Representative Kronk, through the chair. Randy Bates, Director of Water. The answer is once they're in the water, they're in the water. They're in the water column, right? They persist. In what concentration they persist is a different question. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kronk. Any other questions from committee members? Representative Rauscher.
Through the chair, how does this get here? I mean, does it come in a powder and we mix it up? Does it come across Canada in a bowl of foam? Does it come across a boat in a giant tub of foam? How does it get here? How does it begin to be in Alaska? I mean, before it gets in the fire truck, what is it?
Thank you, Representative Rauscher. I think Ms. Larson should be able to provide some insight to that.
Representative Rauscher?
Yes.
Through the chair. When it comes up in the form of aqueous film forming foam, which is a firefighting substance. And then apart from that, when we talk broadly about the like family of PFAS compounds, it's ubiquitous. It comes in all kinds of forms on your nonstick pans, in your microwavable popcorn bag. It is everywhere, which is why, which is supportive of Representative Hannon's statement earlier that, you know, it's in all of us in some form or another. So the question of how it gets here for AFFF is, I imagine, on a tug or a barge. And then how it gets here for everything else is our common shipping pathways.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. With that, I'd like to thank everybody for the robust conversation and for the presentation and bringing the new version of this bill forward. Representative Hannon, if you've got any closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate your interest from all of you, but I am going to just remind you that, you know, currently DEC lists two of the PFAS, PFOA compounds as hazardous. We believe all seven in the bill are significantly toxic to human consumption and are existing in the water columns as a result of AFFF. You know, one of the other things DEC says is, we don't have a database of where it is and where it's been used. Well, we are long past due, and since we've had at least two state agencies collecting data on it since 2018, we better be building the database because, as the chemists say, it's forever chemicals. It's not going away. So as we are collecting the data of where it's been used or where it's been stored or where it's been spilled, we need to be building that database because whether we address it this legislature or whether it's 10 years down the road, the toxicity of it, every time the EPA or state agencies look at it, the exposure limits that create toxic response go down. And it is mind-blowing, Representative Gillum. We are talking to very small elements producing pretty significant health concerns. And so the more we keep track of it, well, the best is not to let it into our water system. But to know where it is and to try and remove it from areas where accidents could expose it to more distribution into water systems. And I know that, you know, Representative Kronk has the pleasure of being the representative from one of the earliest PFAS contamination sites in the state, that's the DOD, where you can't eat the fish from the lakes because there's PFAS in the water. And, you know, those signs that say, you can fish here, but don't eat the fish from here. And that's rare in Alaska. It's not rare across the U.S., and we don't want to be like the rest of the U.S., and we don't want to wait for federal EPA decisions to be had, because as we all know, they say they're a few months out, but there'll be a challenge. There isn't really an expectation that we're going to have any solid guidance from the EPA for another few years. It's going to continue because they're not just dealing with AFFF. They're dealing with all the industrial applications. So instead of seven compounds being talking about, they're talking about the hundreds. And so for Alaskans' health and safety, we should start there and make sure Alaskans have access to safe, clean drinking water as we go forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hannon. I think to that point, in part of my discussions prepping for the meeting, there was discussion of a list of some sort that kind of prioritized the safe water drinking limits throughout Alaska where AFFF was, you know, leaked into, and look forward to that follow-up from the department and make sure it's available to all committee members in preparation for the next time we decide to hear this bill. Again, Representative Hannon, thank you for making it a wonderful meeting, my first meeting back, making sure I can still keep track of what's going on here. So the idea is to set the bill aside, and want to let you guys know that we'll meet tomorrow evening at 6:30 p.m. in room 106 with the House Special Committee on Fisheries to hear some Board of Fish and CFEC appointees. Additionally, the plan is to meet on Friday to hear Senate Bill 204, which is a hunting permit tag auctions raffles by Senator Reback, and continue our hearing on HB 349 by Representative Rauscher. With that, the I want to thank all the folks from DEC and those online to helping us facilitate the discussion and get some answers to some of our concerns and questions as we work through this legislation. And with that, the Resource Committee meeting is adjourned at 2:50 p.m.